Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Chipotle has a new marketing campaign underway. Here's CEO Steve Ells.
For years now, we've been committed to what we call food with integrity. And so the removal of GMOs is just a natural evolution of that.
Why? For a start, the company says scientists are still studying the long-term implications of GMOs. That's true. But as my guest has concluded, the fact that research is ongoing does not necessarily mean the evidence so far suggests eating GMO foods is bad for human health, or even that it is scientifically proven to treat all GMO foods the same, rather than trying to evaluate their health and environmental effects one by one. William Saladin writes about politics, science, and technology for Slate. His article, Unhealthy Fixation, was published last month. You can find it at kera.org/think. Will, welcome to Think.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
You write that the deeper you dig into the evidence, the more fraud you find in the case against GMOs. And those arguing that GMOs are dangerous are hoping most of us won't understand the science?
Yeah, GMOs is an incredibly complicated field because it's not even one thing. There are multiple different kinds of genes that are being engineered in different ways into different crops for different purposes. So it's enormously complicated. You can understand part of it and not begin to understand the rest of it. And most people just, you know, react by saying, gosh, this is really complicated. And some people say it might be bad for you or hazardous. So I'm just going to stay away from this food. And so it's really hard to fight your way through to a point where you can say, you know what, it's not really true. It's just as safe, or at least we have no reason to believe it's more unsafe than any other kind of food. And so I can go ahead and eat it.
More than half of Americans surveyed believe genetically modified foods are indeed unsafe.
Yeah, that's pretty consistent in polling. There are different ways in which the question can be asked. But, you know, for most ordinary people, I mean, if you're like me, like I was 2 years ago, somebody says, well, there's this study that says GMOs might have, you know, caused tumors in rats. You hear that kind of thing, and even if you heard some you know, science organization say, oh, don't trust us, they're safe, you still think in the back of your head, maybe they're not. And so you kind of give to the benefit of the doubt to, I better stay away from them.
Hmm. What are the most common stereotypes about the potential effects of GMO foods?
The stereotypes about them, I mean, you know, I think what most people think of when they think about GMOs is like Frankenstein. They've heard, there's this phrase that we've heard, Frankenfood.
Right.
You know, it's that we're doing something really weird to food that we never did before, and it can create some sort of unknown effects. So it's that, I mean, I think the stereotype is we're doing weird stuff. It's, we just don't know exactly what it is. One of the ones that people really love in a sick way, I mean, that people get attached to, is the idea that, oh, you're taking a gene from one species and putting it in another species where it doesn't belong, and that is somehow, you know, perverted and dangerous. So that's, I think those are some of the common stereotypes.
Does that happen in nature, that cross-species genes find their way into the genomes of other species?
Yeah, I would say two things. One, it's not easy. It's not like if you eat, you know, if you eat a fish, that the fish gene is suddenly going to infect you. It's not like a virus, right? It doesn't happen that way. But it's also true that over the long run, nobody owns a gene. You know, genes, we are, after all, related to every other species on Earth. And so a gene from one species can end up in another species. It doesn't have to be through some kind of infection process. And so it isn't as though there are natural boundaries to where genes belong.
Lots of influential medical groups, including the WHO, the American Medical Association, have issued statements that assert there is no credible evidence that GMO foods are unsafe. Are they doing their own research, though, or relying on studies published by companies with a financial interest in these foods?
Oh, boy, the corporations and their studies is a huge topic. It's hard to really do justice to this. So let me be fair to the anti-GMO side and say, look, there is a track record of companies that were involved in bad stuff like pollution or tobacco, right, doing their own studies and underplaying risks. And so for that reason, it is totally natural to be skeptical of them and to say, well, if anybody in this study ever went to a conference where Monsanto bought the coffee or something like that, then you should discount the study. But at the same time, it's sort of sensible to step back and say, you know, is there anything about this research that we should be suspicious of in the first place other than whether it might be connected to a corporation somehow in some distant way? Also, you know, it's just as true. I mean, we should ask, if you're going to apply a standard like that to GMOs, you should apply it to all food. Like, ask, you know, sometimes the people say, well, the FDA doesn't do its own safety studies. It outsources those safety studies to the companies that produce the food. Well, you know what? That's true of all food. So, you know, if you're going to be suspicious, be equally suspicious.
I love this line you write. When you cling to an unsubstantiated belief, even after two decades of research and experience, that's not skepticism. It's dogma.
Yeah, it's really hard to know the point at which you've crossed over, because you start out saying, whoa, what is this new GMO stuff they're doing? They're engineering genes into my food? Wait a minute. And, you know, you say, well, I want to see some studies on that. And they do some initial studies. And you say, well, I want to see some longer-term studies. And then they do something a little bit longer-term. And eventually, it gets to be where it's 15, 20 years later, and people have been eating this food, like genetically engineered papayas, and nobody's dropping dead, nobody's getting sick. And at some point, you got to realize, well, you know, we don't need more research for this than we need for all the other food that I eat without thinking about it. And so I guess at some point, you know, if you're still saying, well, GMOs are dangerous, but there hasn't been any evidence to prove that GMOs are dangerous, at that point, you got to say, well, now the benefit of the doubt shifts, and I'm going to assume that this food is safe to eat.
Is there a gold standard for studying the safety of food? Is it done in a lab setting or in population studies?
Well, you know, all research that's done on safety, ideally what you'd like is what they call a double-blind randomized controlled study, you know, where this is pretty hard to do, but where you take a population of people and you do it over a long period of time. And you would sort of, they wouldn't know whether they were eating the GMO or the non-GMO. And so you'd get rid of placebo effects, and you'd track them for a long time so that just in case there's some hidden effect that you're not sure about that didn't show up in the first 2 or 3 years. So yeah, there's a gold standard, but you know, the question is, how long are you willing to hold up the technology in order to satisfy that gold standard, particularly when, in some cases, you know, I think about what's on the other side of the equation. You know, you're holding up the development of crops or food, which might be better for the consumer. And in some cases, like one of the case studies I went into is called Golden Rice. Mm-hmm. And that's where they're trying to develop a crop that would basically save, you know, thousands upon thousands of lives every year. And for something like that, do you really want to sort of say, well, let's wait 50 years to make sure this is absolutely positively no doubt about it, safe? You know, I guess the standards have to be particular to the context.
Golden Rice was developed to create a simple solution to the problem of sometimes fatal vitamin A deficiency in Southeast Asia. Honestly, we've been hearing about this for so long, Will. I was shocked to read in your article that it still is not commercially available.
Yeah, and I want to be fair to the anti-GMO side because, you know, in the article, I describe how during the entire time the rice has been in development, which is about 15 years, the anti-GMO side has been fighting to slow it down at every turn. And that is absolutely true. But it is also true that the rice developers have had technical trouble. So right now they're trying to end – what they have to do is once they've – I mean, what they did was a miracle. Nobody had ever done this before. They engineered a crop to produce a nutrient that crop had never produced before. Rice to make beta-carotene, which makes vitamin A, which, you know, will cure blindness in lots of kids all over the world and prevent death. It's a totally amazing thing. So they did that in the rice, but now they're trying to sort of breed that trait back into the kind of rice that people in Southeast Asia are eating. And that's very difficult. So, yeah, for a number of reasons, golden rice is still not available. And it would be great if we could get it, but it will require more than politics. It will require some science to get there.
So opponents of golden rice, just on its merits, they're okay with synthetic vitamin A capsule distribution in lieu of giving people a genetically modified food?
Yeah, and this is one of the weird things about the anti-GMO movement that I, you know, sort of I saw it as a pattern as I was doing the research. It is that they make arguments against GMOs, which if you take them on their own, okay, well, it makes, you know, it sounds reasonable. You know, well, we don't want to feed this untested product to these kids in a study, or we don't want to, like, feed them to kids in the Philippines without, you know, they might be dangerous, this rice, because it produces beta carotene. Well, the same activists at the same time are saying, instead of the rice, we should just hand out these vitamin A capsules, which have like three times the quantity of vitamin. And it's not even beta carotene, it's vitamin A, which means that your body can't regulate it in the same way, can't protect itself from an overdose in the same way. And there's just no, it's like a cognitive disjunction that they can't see, that they're arguing against the GMOs by, as you were putting it before, a gold standard that they're not applying to the non-GMOs. So what I say to the public is, you know, look, if you're listening out there and you're concerned about GMOs, I can't promise you that every GMO you might eat is safe, but I can't say the same about any non-GMO either. And if you're going to be wary about what you put in your body, just apply the same standards to both kinds of food.
William Salatin is my guest. He's politics, science, and technology writer for Slate, and he recently published an article called Unhealthy Fixation. You can find a link to it on the think page of KERA.org. If you'd like to join the conversation, the number is 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@KERA.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Fall registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Slate politics, science, and technology writer William Salatin. His article, Unhealthy Fixation, was published last month in Slate. You can find a link to it online at kera.org. Will, some people might say, what about long-term effects? You know, I might do a six-month study on cigarettes with new smokers and conclude they were pretty safe. But of course, we know that over the course of 60 years, many, many people who use them frequently will get sick.
Yeah, well, obviously cigarettes is a different case. For one thing, I think you'd find that in the first few months of smoking cigarettes, you'd see symptoms. Mm-hmm. You'd see signs that something is wrong here, and that would sort of cue you in that to look for longer term damage. There's also mechanisms of action in the case of tobacco for understanding why those would be harmful to you and why they'd be carcinogenic. There aren't really clear mechanisms of action in the case of GMOs. They're sort of speculation. There's the occasional anecdotal and or small study that suggests that maybe there's some kind of correlation, but they never have a good control group for it. They never are able to replicate it. So it's kind of the occasional outlier study in search of a theory. So I would say that there are some fundamental differences between what you would know about cigarettes in the first few months and what you would know about a GMO.
Okay, you mentioned papaya earlier. I want to talk about this. The Hawaiian papaya industry had this battle against something called ring spot virus. The virus is harmless to humans, but it really would wreck crops. How did scientists tinker with DNA to create plants that were resistant to the virus?
Well, that is a very complicated and interesting story. So what there was a scientist named Dennis Gonsalves who basically saved the Hawaiian papaya crop. This was a virus, the ring spot virus, that was wiping out the crop. And they tried, the farmers and the agricultural scientists tried everything they could. They rotated crops. They tried to basically find a way to defeat the virus or get around it. And nothing was working and the crop was being wiped out. They eventually tried, what he tried was to was to take a gene from the virus itself, from the coat protein, which is a relatively harmless outer part of the virus, and transfer that into the DNA of the papaya itself. And the theory was that the papaya might then become immune to the virus. And it worked. They developed this genetically engineered papaya that was that survived the virus. But now there's an interesting debate now about what exactly is the mechanism by which it's working. Is it that gene, or is it what they call RNA interference that's causing it? And that's not resolved at this point. I don't want to drag your listeners too far into the weeds on that. But so they're not sure about the mechanism, but the effect of it is they have engineered a crop to survive a pathogen. And they basically saved an entire industry that was very important to Hawaii.
Some people said, well, maybe this GMO version will be bad for people with certain allergies.
Yeah, and there were investigations of allergy is always an anxiety, right? People are very concerned about allergies now. Things might be allergenic. What they do is they check against known allergen databases. And, you know, initially, you can do studies where you say, well, there's a chemical resemblance between this gene, between this what they engineered into the papaya and a known allergen. Well, it turns out that remember we were talking earlier about the gold standard. Mm-hmm. If you use a very low standard of resemblance, yeah, you'll find that something can be called allergenic because it resembles a known allergen. But then you find out that everything else is allergenic by that standard, and that isn't true, clearly. So when you raise the standard and you look for a tighter correlation between the known allergen and the chemical you're testing for, you find out that the papaya is not, by that standard, allergenic. And there's not been some outbreak of allergies in Hawaii or anywhere else from eating that papaya.
Okay, I want to move on and talk about insecticides and GMOs. This is really fascinating. There's a bacterium called Bacillus thuringiensis, and I don't know if I said that even close to correctly, but we'll call it BT from now on. It occurs in nature, known to keep certain pests off foods if it's, made somewhere in a factory and applied topically. What are its effects on non-insects, the effects of BT?
Well, BT, it's designed, it was chosen because it was lethal to insects and not to vertebrates. So the scientific consensus, I can tell you, is that it is harmless to vertebrates. There are some, outlier scientists and activists who want to claim that it's dangerous, but they weren't claiming this until BT became a GMO. And this is what's interesting about BT. So it was a bacterium that they discovered was lethal to insects, and they said, great, we'll make an insecticide out of it. And farmers used this, not as a GMO, they just sprayed the bacterium on their crops for decades, and everybody loved it. It's used in organic farming. The organic industry loves it. If you buy organic food, you're getting food that, a lot of food that was sprayed with BT. And you can have BT residue, which has been found on, on produce in Europe and other places. So not until the late 1990s, when they took the gene from the bacterium and engineered it into the crop so that the crop would become insecticidal itself. Same insecticide, but produced by the crop itself. Not until then did all these people start freaking out about BT and claiming that BT was harmful. And this is a pattern with the anti-GMO industry. And so if you go back to the rule, apply the same standards to your food, you have to ask yourself, wait, if the BT is really dangerous, why should I only pay attention to that argument when you're talking about a GMO crop and not to all the food that I eat that's sprayed with BT? And the example that I use in the article is Germany, where there's all these restrictions on GMOs. We don't want people to be eating the BT crops. But meanwhile, in Germany, you're getting sprayed, something like 100 pounds an acre of biopesticides, which is mostly BT, as far as the research indicates. And that's been sprayed on the crops in Germany. So, again, it's apply the same standards to both sides.
You note that Greenpeace first argued that the BT concentration in GMO plants was higher than it would be if farmers sprayed it on. Then they argued that it was present in concentrations too small to make a difference.
Yeah, I mean, it's a complicated. There's these two arguments about BT. One is that it's bad for people, right? It must be. There's something dangerous. As soon as it became a GMO, the argument was, oh my God, it's toxic. Meanwhile, when Greenpeace actually goes out and does the research, they find that the amount of BT that's in the that's being produced by these genetically engineered crops is actually much lower than they thought. So they've been hyping it. It turns out it's much lower. Now, at this point, if you're sort of an honest environmentalist, you would think that you would say, we were wrong. You know, it turns out that the that their BT that's in the crops is not more dangerous. There's not more of it. But instead, they turn around and say, well, there's so little BT in these crops that it's probably not even killing the bugs. And so they use it for this other argument they have, which is that it be, because it doesn't kill the bugs become resistant to it. And, it just sort of, to me, it indicated that they have a conclusion, which is that GMOs are bad, and they are reaching for any argument that will support that conclusion, whether it's a safety argument or an environmental argument or a pesticide effectiveness argument.
And you write that GMOs are under attack while biopesticides flourish. It's surprising that people aren't upset about biopesticides, and I don't know enough about them to say they're all safe or unsafe, but is there some reason that people aren't, you know, yelling about finding biopesticides in their organic foods?
Well, I don't know the actual answer to that, but my speculation would be slightly discomforting, and the speculation would be the people who use biopesticides to a significant extent, if not primarily, are organic companies. And organic companies are up to their eyeballs in the anti-GMO movement. The Organic Consumers Association, which represents the organics industry, is – so when you see these fights going on over GMO labeling and ballot measures in this or that state and legislation, there is an industry on one side which is promoting GMOs. Right. And there's an industry on the other side that's promoting organics. And I think the people, the GMO corporations are spending more. And the food industry doesn't want to spend money on labeling. So they're spending to defeat that. But don't kid yourself. There is an industry on the other side. And I would guess that the reason why they're not, you know, up in arms about biopesticides is that they're the people who use and benefit from them.
We have an email here from Alfred who says, if GMO food is safe, why not label GMO food as such?
You know, that is an enormously intuitive argument, and it's being used in Washington right now to argue for GMO labeling. It's used in every state where it's debated, and it has a lot of intuitive appeal. You know, why shouldn't I know about it? And my conclusion from doing the research was that the GMO label itself is misleading. I am against GMO labeling because the myth about GMO labeling is that it will tell you what is in your food. It doesn't actually tell you what's in your food. It tells you how by what processes your food has been genetically altered, but it doesn't tell you about the content. So, for example, and we did a quiz in Slate where you can go through and choose the GMO or non-GMO, and we give you, in effect, a GMO label. We give you a label that says, this is the one that's, this product is labeled GMO, and here's the argument for why it's dangerous. And then we give you the non-GMO alternative. And after you buy the non-GMO, at the end, you can click to see your results. You get a cart, you know, you check out and you see. And what you find out is that you were that the important information about your non-GMO food was concealed by the fact that it didn't have a GMO label. So, for example, you bought the non-GMO produce. You avoided the BT crop, the BT corn or whatever it was in the shopping cart. You bought the non-GMO corn and you got BT anyway, and that was hidden from you by the fact that there wasn't a label on it. So that's just one example of why I think GMO labeling misleads the consumer more than it informs the consumer.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Bruce in Pantego. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me on. I want to say I agree mostly with what our guest says about, you know, not being labeling and so forth. I think there's also like a significant faction of the anti-GMO community that doesn't think that GMOs or like vaccines are inherently dangerous, but there are some people that are wary of the corporate control over the GMOs themselves. And if we address, maybe make a better patent system, those fears would probably be more alleviated.
What do you think about that, Will?
Yeah, that is first. I think the caller is making a very important point, and let me just step back for a minute and elaborate on it. It's important to separate the issues, okay? You should be suspicious of me or anyone else who tells you there is one big answer to everything. So if I go in and do the research, I did four case studies, and I found that even within sort of within the safety debate, in different ways, the safety arguments checked out in this, on behalf of the GMOs. But then I went into herbicide resistance, which is another application, and that's more problematic. That is a problematic application of GMO, so they're not all the same. And what the caller is raising about corporate control of food, that's another issue. And just because the GMOs may be as safe as, or there's no reason to believe they're more unsafe than any other kind of food, does not mean that everything about GMOs is hunky-dory. And so, you know, in the case of corporate control, yeah, you should, you know, you if you're interested in public control of agriculture or in at least diverse control of agriculture and local farming and that sort of thing. And there are all sorts of environmental reasons. There are economic reasons why you might be for that. Those are all legitimate concerns to raise about how we do GMOs. But again, you should distinguish the issues, and you have to apply the same standards to both sides. And the illustration that I would give for that in this case is, so say you're concerned about corporate control. So you're concerned about Monsanto and, you know, Bayer and DuPont and all these other big companies that are in agriculture. Well, it turns out that all of these companies have spent billions, I mean billions of dollars to move into the biopesticide industry. And that is growing at leaps and bounds. So, yeah, you should be concerned about the big corporations and their control of GMOs. But you better also be concerned about them buying into the organics industry and getting control of that too. So just make sure that if your focus is corporate control, don't confuse that with drawing conclusions in general about GMOs.
You said this term herbicide resistance. In layman's terms these days, that is talking about crops that are Roundup ready or similar. I was really surprised to read about the evidence for and against the use of Roundup, which is, I guess, glyphosate. Is that the chemical name for it?
Yes. Yes, it's glyphosate.
Tell us a little bit about what's known about its effects on health and safety, and then its effects on the broader environment.
Well, glyphosate, this is not an area where I am particularly an expert. I have looked at the World Health Organization evaluations, and there are other people who are more up to speed on chemical properties who can get into this. But in general, pesticides, the world of pesticides is very tricky because you're looking for chemicals that will kill pests, and often will kill specific pests. You're trying not to kill other pests, and you're trying not to produce any effects that might be harmful to mammals or to people. And that can be difficult because of, you know, it's just difficult to find things that do one but not the other. So what you often end up with is you end up with a balance where you have a chemical which can be in high volume, if sort of profusely applied, and over a long period, it can be environmental consequences that you don't want, and it might have effects on mammals or on people that you don't want. So glyphosate and there's a huge debate about this, and I really don't want anybody to walk away from what I say thinking that I have the final answer. But the World Health Organization recently put glyphosate in a category called probable carcinogens. They did not quantify how much glyphosate was needed to be possibly carcinogenic. It is in a similar category with some other chemicals. It is not quite in the category with coffee, but it's close. So there are, and if you look at the list of pesticides that have been replaced by glyphosate, they by and large are worse. They are in worse categories of potentially or likely carcinogenic. So it's weird to say this, but when somebody tells you that something is in the category of probable or possible carcinogens, that doesn't actually end the debate unless you can find another pesticide that can do the job that is not even in the probable or possible carcinogen category.
William Salatin is my guest. He writes about politics, science, and technology for Slate. His article, Unhealthy Fixation, was published last month in Slate. You can find a link to it online at kera.org. If you want to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Slate writer William Salatin. He published an article on the site last month called Unhealthy Fixation about GMOs. You can find a link to it on the Think page of KERA.org. If you'd like to join the conversation, call in to 1-800-933-5372. Will, lots of people hear about GMOs and worry about the effect of these genes in crops somehow recombining in the wild and affecting nearby ecosystems?
Well, I think what they're concerned about is the seeds just is cross-pollination. And that can happen. And that's one of the things that regulatory agencies look for when they evaluate these crops. So, but there, it's important to distinguish among, first of all, sometimes regulations are imposed to keep the crops sufficiently far apart that they won't cross-pollinate. But the other thing is there are differences among the crops in the degree to which they do. So, for example, the papaya, one reason why the papaya is different from the other GMO crops is that it itself pollinates, and so it was decided there was no danger of cross-pollination in that case. It is a legitimate concern to the extent that people want to separate GMOs from non-GMOs, but you have to sort of take it on a case-by-case basis.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Chris in Dallas. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
In regards to what you were talking about, I am concerned with the sustainability of agriculture, and I believe it's called the Terminator gene or something along those lines that is being engineered into these plants that makes it to where, you know, farmers have to rebuy these seeds every year and, creates this cycle. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, these GMO producers are putting this trademark on it that says, oh, well, if you want to grow this, then you have to, you know, continually buy this every year. And it seems to me that sustainability would be a better argument for, you know, feeding the population and you know, these places that, don't have a lot of food and so.
Will, do you know anything about that?
Well, Monsanto, for example, denies that they have done this. The argument that I have heard, and this is not something that I have, this is not one of the areas that I really went into in the research. I just sort of have a superficial knowledge of it from what I read. Was that in a lot of cases, if not in most cases, the farmers, like the major commercial farmers, actually want new seeds. They want the latest developed seeds for the new crop. They don't want to replant. That in a lot of contexts, if not most, the replanted seeds don't perform as well. But that setting that aside, that it's just not true that they've commercialized a Terminator technology. This is a story that went around. And it's possible that initially there was something to it, but as far as I understand, it just isn't true. It hasn't been true for a long time.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. I wonder, Will, if some of the problem here, some of the concerns people have is that, listen, we're all busy, right? There's a million things going on. We know it's important what we eat, but it's really hard to figure out what that should be. We get conflicting messages. A lot of people feel like if they know that the food they're eating doesn't have any GMO ingredients or it's organic, that it must be healthy for our bodies. And I just pulled up an image of organic Oreos online. And, I don't know that that's necessarily a solution, but it feels like a good shorthand step toward doing what's right for our diets.
Yeah, I would encourage everyone, if you think of yourself, this is a general point about skepticism, right? So you think of yourself as a person who is careful, skeptical, you want to make sure, don't trust industry, make sure you're only putting safe things in your body. If in doubt, don't. You follow these general rules when you're buying groceries. I guess I would encourage you, don't be selective in how you apply that. And be very wary when you are told to target a particular kind of food for scrutiny, and to somehow be less wary of other food. So I mean, certainly if you go to our article in Slate and you take the – in fact, you could probably just Google GMO shopping quiz and you'll probably get it in the Slate article. I would encourage you to try that quiz. There's basically six choices. So we try to simulate a shopping trip. And what the quiz really gets at is if you go through that shopping trip and you read these warnings about the GMO product and you play it safe, you think you're playing it safe and you buy the non-GMOs, again and again, you find out that what you bought wasn't safe, or I would put it this way, it wasn't any safer, wasn't any less likely to be unsafe than the GMO alternative. In some cases, it's definitively less good for you. And in the case of they're developing, I think they just commercialized the GMO potato, which produces, when it's fried, less acrylamide. Acrylamide, again, we go back to carcinogens. Acrylamide, when it's is a chemical which is carcinogenic. So they have produced by GMO this potato that has less of this carcinogen when it's fried. And if you're avoiding the GMO and you're buying what you think of as the safe organic product, the safe organic potato, you know, are you actually ending up with a safer product, or have you been snookered into rejecting one kind of theoretical unsafety and getting a practical, real, less safe product in exchange?
We have an email here from Earl who writes, I can wash my produce before use, which means I can reduce topically applied BT. I cannot remove any of the intrinsically produced BT in a GMO. This seems like a reasonable rebuttal for the argument against them.
Yeah, that's true. You can wash away any topically applied pesticide. It is also true that if you read the GMO brochures, not the GMO, the brochures for BT sprays, which is what the organic farmers are using, they are telling the farmers to keep spraying that you have to continuously spray with BT because it degrades. And they are telling you can spray on the day that you harvest the crop. They are telling you can spray your stored grain. You've already harvested it. You can spray it up to the last minute. They're telling the farmer this because they say BT is perfectly safe to eat. Now, the truth is BT is perfectly safe to eat. And the reason that I bring up the volume of BT that is found in food is because it is no more unsafe to eat the GMO version than the non-GMO version. So yes, you can wash it off, although I have to say we also linked to a study where they investigated the produce that was on the shelves in, I think it was Denmark, and found lots of BT on that. So if you're washing it all off, good for you, but there are lots of other people who might miss something, and they are definitely eating some BT.
And it probably is hard to wash it off something like grain, especially if you purchase it already milled.
Yeah, how many of you, if you do you rinse all your grain before you use it in any form? Do you, if you, in the case of something like, that's BT, if you get over into the beta carotene issue where, people say, well, we don't want this beta carotene production engineered into our rice, so we'll eat food that has it topically applied. That food, you can't wash off. That's flour and stuff that is being centrally processed, and the vitamin A and the beta carotene are being put into it while it's on its way to the consumer.
So you've made some really strong arguments here. I would imagine some people are interested in what you have to say and believe you. Some people still disagree. My question for you is this. Do you think organizations actively working against GMOs right now are run by people who know that GMOs are safe but somehow want to keep them off our tables anyway? Because what would motivate anybody to go to all that trouble?
No, I don't think so. I think what happens is, and this is just a general point about human nature, you become committed to a cause either initially or over time, and it is really, really hard to let go. It is especially hard the longer you're invested in it. It's really hard to turn around and say, you know what, this was a mistake. And it's not even that you have to say it was a mistake. The people who are up in arms about GMOs, many of them, have good reasons. It's just that they've misapplied them to GMOs. If you're concerned about, sustainable agriculture, if you're concerned about consumer safety, if you're concerned about, corporate control, these, patents and all that stuff, these are all legitimate concerns. It's just that using GMOs as a category, treating that as a proxy for all those issues, was mistaken. So it's really hard if you're Greenpeace to turn around and say, you know what? Gosh, we found out there isn't that much BT in these crops. The GMO, it's not a safety issue, and we need to turn our attention elsewhere. What are you going to say to all the people for whom you've raised money, all the doors you've knocked on, you've told people this is what we're fighting for? So I salute the courage of the people who are able to turn around. It is difficult to do that. I don't think that these are, you know, sinister motives on the anti-GMO side. I just think it's an ideological commitment that's really hard to let go of.
Do you know how GMOs got lumped into one gigantic category as opposed to saying, you know, sort of looking at this as potatoes that produce fewer carcinogens or, you know, grain that produces its own insecticide or is herbicide resistant? Was there a moment at which it could have gone either way? Either we considered all these things individually or we just put them into a big category and assumed that they were all something that we might be concerned about?
You know, that's a great question, Chris. I think that it's precisely because GMOs are such a large, diverse, complicated field that there is a human psychic need to simplify. And I think when somebody offers you a term like GMO, and, you know, if you go back to the early days, 15, 20 years ago, people talking about Frankenfoods, and, you know, there was something that seemed creepy about it because it was novel at the time. And now it's less so, but we've created this category for it, and we're still unnerved about it. And it's really hard. I can tell you, you know, having spent a year going into different GMO technologies, different crops, different applications, it's really hard to investigate the merits of each particular case. So I think for a lot of people, they want to stick a GMO label on the product because they just want to stay away from any risk. It's just too hard to sort out what's safe and what's not, what's produced by, you know, Monsanto and what's produced by Hawaiian farmers.
Let's go to the phones now. We have James on the line in Plano. Hey, James.
Yes, good afternoon. I have a quick question. Great show, by the way, today. The concern of the BT being distributed to virtually all edible plant material by human beings, how does this, what's the difference between what occurs in nature from the BT and what is used in the GMOs? Is this expanded beyond the plant life where it's only is it limited to just the plants that produce it naturally, or do all plants produce this naturally? How does this affect the bee population in the process of pollination? Does it kill the bees?
What do you know about that, Will?
I'm trying to remember. I investigated. The bees was an alley that I went down, and I ended up not going into non-human environmental issues. But I know that there in the butterflies is another case where people said the GMO was affecting. These are often complicated downstream effects. So in the case of the butterflies, it was somehow affecting it was pesticide affecting the food chain, affecting the butterflies. I hesitate to try to venture into that. I know that these are questions of application. However, they are not questions about GMOs, but they are about the application thereof. And I would encourage the listener and anyone else to distinguish all of these cases. So even if you end up agreeing with me that GMOs are just as safe for humans as non-GMOs, maintain your scrutiny of these other issues like insect populations. This doesn't resolve whether a GMO is being applied in such a way that might be damaging to an important species. And so those are separate questions, and I wouldn't want to pretend to resolve them for you.
So was it a relief to you to come to this conclusion that most GMOs are not as you used the phrase perfectly evil as you had imagined they might be before you undertook this investigation?
I wouldn't say that when I started it, I thought they might be evil. I just thought it was really, really complicated and it was too hard to, I mean, and my relief really was being able to explain it well enough that a lot of people understood it. Because I think for most of us, we just don't have the time to do this kind of research. And, you know, some of us say, look, just stick a label on it so I can avoid it just in case. And I was really relieved to be able to say, you know what, there is a way to understand this, to make sense of it, so that you don't need the label, because the label is really the wrong answer, and it will take us in the wrong direction in terms of knowledge and precision. And so my relief wasn't so much for my safety, which I wasn't particularly concerned about when I started. It was more being able to explain this in a way that hopefully, I mean, my job as a journalist is to make you as a listener and a reader smarter and make you an intelligent consumer. And I hope that that's what I've been able to do in the article.
William Salatin writes about politics, science, and technology for Slate. His article, Unhealthy Fixation, was published last month and remains available online. Will, it's been a really interesting hour. I so appreciate you making time for us.
Thank you for having me on, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. On Twitter, I am at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.